Well, good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. This is Vox Pop on WAMC for Thursday, April 5th. Great news, boys and girls. Astronomer Bob Berman is here. The bad news is he has the flu or a cold or some sort of an illness. The good news is it's a call-in program. You can't catch any germs. The bad news is I'm in Studio A with him. And, you know, these are the kind of sacrifices Bob makes and I make for you, the radio listener. If you have an astronomy question, give us a call now at 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. He's illin', but he's Bob Berman, and he's here in the studio to answer your questions. It's Vox Pop. It begins after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We welcome back renowned astronomer Bob Berman to our airwaves today. He's quite intrepid, not feeling 100%, but he's here nonetheless. Our number is 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You know, Bob has many books out there. And his most recent one is not out yet, and I forgot the name of it. But still, we'll talk about it in a moment. Bob Berman, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Ray. Good to be here.
What's the new book?
Cataclysms.
Cataclysms.
Yes.
And when's that out?
You know, they haven't told me the release date yet, but I imagine it's in the fall.
It's all done?
Oh, yeah. I sent it in a month ago. I haven't heard a thing from the publisher.
So this is about worlds in collision and whatnot?
Yeah, the subtitle says galactic collisions, supernovae, and earthly mayhem that shook our universe.
Oh, this is beautiful. This is great. Bob Berman is our guest. If you have a question for Bob about astronomy, 800-348-2551. There was an article on our own, I believe it's on our website. I know it's NPR content. And I think you find it at WAMC.org. We'll find out soon enough. Supermassive black hole lurking at the center of our galaxy appears to have a lot of company, according to a new study that suggests the monster is surrounded by about 10,000 other black holes.
This is cool. This is cool news. I like this because, you know, we're all intrigued by black holes, which come in two types. There are heavy stars that can collapse into a black hole, a star weighing between, let's say, 8 and 20 suns.
Mm-hmm.
Or there are supermassive black holes. One seems to be in the center of every galaxy
right.
in the universe. Our own galaxy has one that's not that impressive. It has the weight of 4 million suns.
That's pretty big.
Yeah, but there are galaxies like M87 that has 9 billion solar mass black holes. So, you know, it still counts. That's the center of our galaxy. And then we've always known about 60... Only 60...
That are scattered throughout.
That are scattered throughout the galaxy, right. That are star... mass, heavy star mass black holes.
Is there any rhyme or reason to the scattering of them?
Well, you'd think that massive stars should form in spiral arms here and there, and a particularly massive star goes through its life pretty quickly and then can collapse into a black hole. So seeing them here and there, you know, made sense. This news indicates that instead of 60 star mass black holes in the galaxy, there is, right near the center, surrounding that 4 million solar mass black hole.
Yeah.
Well, they only found about a dozen, but the way they found it using an X-ray telescope, the Chandra X-ray telescope, shows that there it indicates there's about 10,000.
So they extrapolated based on the size of the galaxy, which is something like 100,000 light years across.
Yes, that in that area near the center there are about 10,000 individual star-sized black holes that are all concentrated in the center of the galaxy.
Are they all falling into the massive black hole?
Not really. They're orbiting around it.
So how does an enormous one, not like the one in the Milky Way, but in other galaxies, how does a really massive black hole form? Stars aren't that big.
Right. It probably accretes. It eats up other things that spiral into it over time.
Very interesting. Well, Bob Berman is our guest. If you have a question about that or anything else under the sun or beyond, it's 800-348-2551. Ellie in Newburgh is first. Ellie, you're on.
Hello?
Yeah, I have a question.
Okay.
I had recently read that a day on Venus lasts longer than a year on Venus. So I guess I have two questions. Is this true? And if so, is this pattern of rotation and revolution found in other planets in our solar system?
No, Ellie, it's unique. And are you my Ellie? Are you the Ellie I know?
You're the I'm the LU know, and I'd also like to ask you how your trip to Alaska with the auroras went.
Oh, it was great. It was great. Just got back about a week ago, but you know, not as good as the time that you came. Those are better auroras, and I miss you not being there.
So it's Ellie. Old home week on the program.
Yeah. Ellie's been on a couple of our tours, and miss not having you there, Ellie.
And they're always great. I gotta tell everybody that's listening that if you ever get a chance to go, just do it. All of his trips are wonderful, and I've been on several.
All right. Well, fantastic. Thank you. Now the question.
Okay, so the question about Venus. Venus is unique in the universe. It spins slower than any celestial body. There's no star, there's no planet, there's no asteroid, there's nothing in space that only rotates at 4 miles an hour.
Why does it do that?
It does from the time it was born. I mean, it's just so rare because anything will make a thing speed up as it shrinks in size, if it gets hit by another celestial body. So it's remarkable to have something that's essentially not spinning. If there was a bike path on Venus's equator and you jogged on it at 4 miles an hour, you could keep the sun from ever setting.
Wow.
And there's nothing like it. So, yes, the year is shorter than the day. To use real figures, if I remember correctly, the amount of time it takes Venus to go around is 229 days. And the time it takes Venus to spin on its axis, that means its day, is 248 days. So its day is longer than its year.
Wow. Ellie, thank you for the call. This intrigues me. Why would it be so much slower than everything else that turns?
Well, something has got to be the winner. I mean, something, you know, when
yeah,
you find the fastest.
4 miles an hour. Now, you mentioned something hitting an object, speeding it up, but could something hitting it in ancient times have slowed it down?
Yes, if it hit it the right way. Yes, quite right. And by comparison, our equator spins at 1,038 miles an hour.
Yeah.
So, and Venus is so-called our sister planet because it's almost the same size. So here we have us at roughly 1,040 miles an hour, and you have Venus at 4.
That's amazing. I never knew that. Ellie, thank you for the call. Bob Berman is our guest. 800-348-2551 is the number. Grace in Sheffield. Grace, you're on.
Hi. My first question is, back when we had the solar eclipse back in August, I know it's that it's a new moon, but I mean, and when there's a full moon, people in nursing homes sometimes are different, and I was wondering if the solar eclipse affected them or if it was just like another new moon.
Well, it's a great question, and the link between phases of the moon, let's say full moon, is the most noticeable, and that's the one that's been studied the most. And human behavior has been ongoing for decades. The biggest study was by a father and son team. I can almost remember their names. In 1958 or 1959, studying a 250,000 births in New York City for links between births and the full moon. And they concluded that, no, the births were slightly linked to the last quarter moon, but even then, not really. But people have often, I mean, we all know that. People say, who teach kindergarten, say, oh, look at the kids today, it's the full moon. People who deal with crime say, is there more crime at the full moon? And we always hear that. But the studies show that it's not true. So we have a different question, which is, why does it seem to have a link that's not there? And we have an answer to that, too.
And what is that?
Whenever there's two things that people notice, in this case, full moon is something everybody notices, and most people will call the moon full even when it's a little out of round.
Okay.
And then the other issue, which could be a crime, burglaries, mental illness, we tend to look for those links. So that, for example, take births. Nurses or doctors on their way to the hospital may say to each other that day, uh-oh, it's a full moon, watch out. And then if there are more births than usual, just by chance, it'll be proof for them.
Uh-huh.
But if there aren't more births, nobody's going to think twice about it and say, oh, this disproves it. So the reinforcement always goes in one direction. And so we get this over and over and over again. So your question, caller, about nursing homes or anything else, all the studies show it's just not true. But it seems to be true, and I just explained why.
All right, Grace, thank you for the call. Bob Berman, our guest. Let's get one more in or two before our first break. And Teresa in Stillwater. Teresa, you're on.
Good afternoon. My question seems so elementary, and there's probably a very simple answer to it. I've noticed the moon. I could see it during the day. And if the moon is a nocturnal type being or planet or whatever, why do I see it during the day? And what does the other side of the world, are they missing out on seeing the moon then?
No. Whenever you're seeing the moon, the people on the other side of the world are going to see it 12 hours later because Earth is spinning. If it's in the sky and it's far enough away from the sun so that the sun's glare isn't blocking it, whenever the moon is a very, very thin crescent, it's very close to the sun, and that can disguise it. But for the whole rest of the lunar cycle, as the moon goes around us, you'll see it. You'll see it by day as much as you'll see it by night, because it's going around Earth and it doesn't care whether it's circling around a part of the Earth that the sun is shining on or the sun isn't shining on. So it's above us during the day and it's above us at night. Of course, we notice it more at night because it's the brightest thing in the night sky. By day, the blue sky is pretty bright. Sometimes the moon is somewhat near the sun. We're not even going to look that in that direction, and so we don't notice it. But quite right. It's there all the time. And when it is out, people on the other side of the world will see it too, but they'll just see it 12 hours earlier or later.
All right. Teresa, perfect question. Thank you very much. We'll take a quick break here. Bob Berman is here. Time for a sip of a warm beverage. Keep that sore throat feeling better. We'll take a break. 800-348-2551. We'll be right back.
Support for Vox Pop comes from Studio KTM Salon Red Hook, specializing in all phases of cut and organic color from corrective to fashion by stylist Kristen Marquette. StudioKTM.com. The Arkell Museum at Canajoharie presenting two exhibits from the museum's permanent collection, Capturing the Essence and Fine Art Animals. Information at ArkellMuseum.org. Quality Foreign Car Care, Ballston Spa, New York. Sales and service of Audi, BMW, Mercedes, Volvo, Saab, Volkswagen, and Porsche. QFCC.com. Stone Soup Concrete, specializing in handcrafted and environmentally sound concrete countertops, sinks, furniture, and floors. Serving the Northeast since 2001, StoneSoupConcrete.com and on Facebook. And from the Hyde Collection in Glens Falls, presenting two exhibitions of Rockwell Kent's art, including ceramics, paintings, and prints. April 8th through July 22nd, HydeCollection.org.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here with you at 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. If you have a question for our guest today, Bob Berman, astronomer par excellence. Bob, these came in via email, and then we'll get back to the phones. This is from Jack in Half Moon, wondering what the sun looks like from the different planets compared to how it looks from Earth as regards to its size and brightness. Also, would the atmospheres of the different planets affect the sun's perceived color? That's from Jack.
Well, our sun, yeah, sure, because the atmosphere is going to color everything in the sky, including the sun. Our sun, from the nearest star, Alpha Centauri, if it has planets, which we don't know if it does, would be a bright star, first magnitude star, in the constellation of Cassiopeia, that W shape in the sky. So from any Alpha Centauris, see our sun as a bright star in Cassiopeia, which would change the shape of that constellation for them.
Neato, but what about, I think what Jack was asking was, say you're on Saturn, what would the size and brightness of the sun look like?
From Saturn, it would be, since Saturn is 9.5 times farther away than we are from the sun, and it goes by the square of distance, so the sun would be 9.5 squared, or roughly 100 times dimmer.
Okay.
It would be 10 times smaller in size, very tiny, and 100 times dimmer.
And by Pluto?
By Pluto, which is averages 40 times farther than we are, the sun is 1,600 times dimmer and 40 times smaller, which is, incidentally, this is interesting, too small to have a disk. So from Pluto, the star would be a point.
Wow.
Exactly. It would
amazing.
Be a point, and it would be a point 1,600 times less bright than we see it, which is still darn bright.
You the brightest thing in the sky
by far.
For Pluto.
Yeah.
All right, this one came in from Alexandra in Latham. We've always heard that the universe is expanding, but the inevitable existential follow-up question is, well, if it's expanding, what's it expanding into?
There's a few ways to tackle that, but the best way to picture this is, if you're asking the question, it means you're visualizing yourself looking at the whole universe from an outside perspective and watching it expand like a balloon blowing up. But there is no outside perspective because nothing and no one is outside the universe by definition to look at the whole universe expanding. So it's a non-existent vantage point. It doesn't exist. And so the question goes away because the thing that you're setting up the question around can't exist. Instead, the best way to picture the expansion is from the actual perspective, which is where inside of it, what do we see with the expansion? We see each galaxy, like our own, not expanding. So our Milky Way is not getting any bigger. We see each cluster of galaxies not expanding, so that our local group of 30 galaxies is holding the same size. But we see other clusters of galaxies moving away from ours. The nearer ones moving away slower, the farther ones moving away faster. For every million light years farther, the galaxies are moving away 14 miles a second faster. So what we see instead, this is what we actually see, is the space between galaxy clusters getting bigger and bigger. And that's the truth. We can all picture it. And then that other question of what it would look like from the outside, since there is no outside, goes away.
Okay. Bob Berman is our guest. The number is 800-348-2551. We go over to Bob in Northville. Bob, you're next.
Hey, thank you for the opportunity.
Sure.
The question focuses upon the order, the harmony, the absolutely beautiful construction of a standard model that we are familiar with. And current physics suggests that there is a supersymmetry, a supersymmetric analog to the particles of the standard model. We are taught to think in terms of particle wave duality. The graviton is introduced recently in the LIGO experiments, detecting gravitation waves. At that scale, I'm curious to know how one would define and describe the graviton. And considering supersymmetry, is there such a thing as a gravitino, as maybe a photino? And then we turn to the issue of likely the impossibility of an anti-graviton. An anti-gravity particle. Care to comment?
Well, of course, since I'm not a particle physicist, I'm going to give you the answers to the extent of my knowledge on this, which is if you had a theoretical physicist dealing, a particle physicist, he might give you a better answer.
Okay.
But yes, you're right. It looks as if the particles are all symmetrical. It does. It makes perfect sense that there is an anti-particle for every particle that exists. And for people who don't know what we're talking about, for example, the electron, one of the most common objects in the universe, subatomic particle with a negative charge of one that orbits, that sit in orbitals around every atom's nucleus, there should be an anti-electron. And sure enough, they've been discovered, and we call anti-electrons positrons. And they're not just theoretical. We use them. If you have a PET scan, that's the P in the PET scan. Positrons are being used. So it really seems real. So that's why the caller's question about gravitons. So my first answer is gravitons have never been discovered yet. They're theorized, but they've not actually been found. So far as anti-gravitons go, gravity is the most mysterious of the four fundamental forces. So gravitons that would be associated with them would still be somewhat mysterious too, and anti-gravitons, if they exist, would have a lot of unsolved questions. Gravitons haven't been found. Anti-gravitons haven't been found. What would be the properties of them? In all other particles, it's simply electrical charge that's reversed. In the case of a graviton, would that actually affect the effect of the graviton? these are good questions. No one has the answer yet.
Okay. Thank you for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is the guest, and Ken in Cornwall is next.
Hey, how you doing? Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
So I had a question. I recently watched the Cosmos program with Neil deGrasse Tyson, and in the program he explained a subatomic particle. I forgot the name, but it's so dense and it's powerful. It can go through the Earth, and they have these pools in Japan with distilled water, and when it's dark, you can see these atoms of some sort coming through the water. I just can't remember what they were called.
They're called neutrinos.
Neutrinos, yes. That I thought neutron. Neutrinos. Can you explain on how they work?
Sure.
And also, I'm going to draw the phone because my service isn't that great.
Okay.
But can you explain how they work? And can you also hit the topic real quick and put all these people in their place that the Earth is not flat? I have a big problem with this. I know it's funny, but
okay.
we need to resolve this problem.
All right. Well,
thank you for taking my call.
Sure. Hopefully, okay. Bob can do that. I don't know.
Yeah, I think I can.
Okay.
Okay. First thing, let's get through the neutrino thing first.
Yes.
Neutrinos are fundamental. There's not a lot of fundamental things in the universe, that is, that can't be divided up any further, that are, so far as we know, basic and that are fundamental building blocks of the universe. Quarks are like that.
Yeah.
Quarks always come in threes, and as they combine together, they form protons and neutrons at the heart of every atom. We used to think these protons and neutrons were fundamental. Now we know, no, they're made of quarks.
But how did they find out?
It's really theoretical considerations, because theoretically there's no quark object, although, about 15 years ago there was talk of maybe a quark star, but that's never been confirmed. So neutrinos are close to massless. They may be massless, or else they're very close to massless. The reason we know that is that in supernova 1987A, the only naked eye supernova in the last 400 years that I took a group down to near the equator to observe, incidentally, mm-hmm. the flash of light from this was almost simultaneous with neutrinos. Now, this was from an object that was about 1,000 light years away. Now, for the neutrinos to arrive as fast as the light, they could only do that if they weighed nothing or darn near nothing, because Einstein tells us that anything with mass can't reach the speed of light. So this and other considerations have showed us that the neutrino is either massless or very, very close to massless. So we have a fundamental particle, the sun's nuclear process. In the sun's core, neutrinos are created all the time. And the fun thing is that because they are close to massless and because they don't interact with ordinary matter, like the baryonic matter in our bodies and in our planet, they fly through the Earth as if the Earth were fog. So by day, 1 trillion neutrinos passes through each of our fingernails per second.
Wow.
4 trillion neutrinos passes through each of our eyeballs every second, coming mostly from the sun. But at night, when the sun is below the horizon, an equal number of neutrinos flies through our body, having passed through the Earth from below in about a 20th of a second, as if it were nothing, as if the Earth were made of nothing, and then passes through our body from down below us and then exits our head and continues into space.
A 20th of a second seems rather slow. If what you're saying is true, that a supernova, how many light years away? 1,000 light years away? And these arrived almost simultaneously with the light, they should go through the Earth a lot faster than 1/20th of a second.
Well, let's do the math. Do you have a calculator? The Earth is 8,000 miles in diameter. The speed of light is 186,282. What percentage of light speed would be 8,000? It seems to me it's close to a 20th.
If it's not exactly the same.
Well, it should be the same, yeah.
You think?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Our number here is 800-348-2551.
And his other question, flat Earth.
Yeah.
Well, let's do that, because more and more people are following the internet and are saying the Earth is flat. They're saying it because the government lies.
Are more and more people, or is it just one of those things that's out there and people look at it and they say, wow,
I don't know.
That's
my kids tell me they're hearing it from their friends.
That the Earth is flat.
Oh, yes.
I
and
see.
That it's all over the internet.
Oh,
and
good.
When I did a big astronomy program at Wanderlust in Killington, Vermont a few years ago, and I arrived at the office, the first thing one of the staff did was say, "Hey, did you hear? The Earth is flat." And it's all over the internet. And I said, "Well, what about the photographs?" "No, they're lies." "What about the astronauts' reports?" "No, they work for the government. They're lying." Why would the government say this? They don't have an answer for that. But is there any way? Here's the thing. If people really believe that it's all a lie from the government and won't believe pictures and won't believe astronaut accounts,
okay,
how can you find out whether it's flat or not? And I have the answer.
All right, tell us.
Here's what you say to your friends who really believe this. How you can answer it for yourself. Do you have friends in California? Most of us do.
No, I don't.
You don't have any. You don't have any. What about relatives?
I don't really have any friends around here.
Oh, all right. So let's say for those who have friends in California, the next day at sunset here or wherever you live, call up your friends in California and say, "Look out the window and tell me how high the sun is in the sky." They'll tell you it's halfway up the western sky.
Okay.
But if it's on the horizon here because the sun is setting, but it's halfway up the sky there, then the Earth can't be flat, can it? Because if the Earth were flat, we'd all be looking towards the same angle to see the sun.
Yeah.
And if it were on the horizon here, it would be on the horizon in California. End of the story. You and your friends could solve this for yourself.
Okay.
And the other way, this is very cool. The next time you're in a large lake, that means smooth water,
yeah,
not waves, not the ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Hold your breath. Sink down so that your eyes are just an inch or two above the lake surface.
Okay.
And look at the distant shoreline, and you'll see it vanishes over the horizon. Because even a lake a few miles across has enough of a curve of the Earth between you and the shoreline that the curvature will block the distant shore.
Yeah.
And if the Earth wasn't curved, you could go down all the way to the water level and you'd still see that far beach. But you can see the curve of the Earth for yourself in a large flat.
Okay. All right, Bob, you've done the job. We appreciate it. Gene in Peru. Gene, you're on at 800-348-2551.
Hi, it's actually Jane. Thank you.
Oh, hi, Jane.
Hi. So I do believe that the Earth is a sphere or nearly one. I'm not one of those people. But I'm wondering, similar back to Grace's question earlier, your guest alluded to the idea of confirmation bias, I guess distorting our attention to the odd behaviors that take place during the time of the full moon. And I'm wondering, as we approach spring, if he could speak to some of the folklore that tells me I should be planting by the phases of the moon.
Well, I mean, you do astronomy edit for the Farmer's Almanac,
yes.
So come on, man. Let's hear it.
I am the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac, and millions are millions of readers. Many of them buy the Old Farmer's Almanac for planting advice, and planting by the phase of the moon is a big part of it.
Okay.
Now, the question is this just folklore? Is there really something to it? Since putting down the Old Farmer's Almanac would be a dumb thing for me to do.
Exactly.
I'm going to avoid the question and merely say this. I actually don't know about planting by the moon, but so far as the other moon effects, we can divide them into two categories. One, the things that it really does. Obviously, the moon affects the tides, and not only the tides, but it affects the sea life that live around the tides. In other words, the big intertidal marshes that gulls, that crabs scurry along, that their predators like gulls feed upon, all their behavior.
Yeah.
Of all this marine life is attuned to the tides and therefore attuned to the moon's phases. So we're not going to say the moon does nothing to us. The big fault lies in people thinking that, well, if the tides can affect the mighty oceans, and if my body is mostly water, well, of course the moon should pull on my bodily fluids. And that's just a misunderstanding of how tides work. Because in truth, the moon is far too weak to pull on water at all. Not one molecule of water rises toward the moon. Simply because every bit of water is pulled by Earth's gravity downward,
mm-hmm,
by the moon's gravity upward, and the Earth's gravity is so much stronger both because Earth is 81 times more massive and because it's so much closer than the moon. The moon does not have a chance to lift anything. But what happens is when the moon is not directly overhead, but at some angle in the sky, which is usually the case, there's a horizontal motion that the moon has on every water droplet that's not opposed by anything. When it's overhead, the vertical motion is opposed by Earth's gravity.
Okay.
We get that.
Yes.
But if the moon's at an angle, let's say near the horizon, the horizontal pull has no opposite pull. So in truth, the way it works is that the oceans move sideways, horizontally toward the moon, and it all accumulates until, on average, there's a 3-foot bulge that piles up under the moon. Not because the moon is pulling straight up under on that bulge, but sideways on all
so
the rest of the ocean.
So why isn't pulling it on our 70% water bodies?
Okay, here's why. Because the way tides work is that there's only an effect if there's a difference between the moon's pull on one side of you, the nearest side where the moon's pull is stronger, and on the far end where it's weaker. Now, in the case of the Earth, we're 8,000 miles in diameter. That's a few percent of the moon's distance.
Yeah.
So there's a stronger, by about 7%, stronger moon's pull on the nearer side of Earth, nearer side to the moon, than on the far side. And this difference is not what produces the tidal effect. It is the tidal effect.
Oh.
What a tidal effect is the difference in pull between one side of a body and the other. Now, let's say you, Ray, step outside, the moon is overhead. What's the difference between the moon's strength on your head and the moon's pull on your feet? It's nothing. It's zero. And therefore, your bodily fluids have no inclination to migrate from their usual spots.
What if it's on the horizon and I'm standing in one place and never move?
It's still no difference between one side of your body and another.
Okay.
And if there's no difference in it, there's no inclination to move.
Well, Bob, you're really disabusing a lot of us of a lot of notions. Apparently, the Earth is not flat. And let's take a break here while we digest all this. 800-348-2551. It could just be the cold medicine affecting Bob. We'll find out in the home stretch.
Support for WAMC comes from Colby Attorney's Service, corporate formations, document retrieval services, court filings, and legal publishing for legal and professional community. Since 1939, ColbyService.com. The Henyon Bakery, Amherst, since 1993, offering hearth-baked whole grain breads, pastries, birthday, wedding, and special occasion cakes, as well as gluten-free offerings. HenyonBakery.com. Interim Healthcare for 47 years, helping families keep loved ones at home, providing companions, aides, and nurses in the Greater Capital Region, Columbia and Saratoga counties, as well as Glens Falls. InTermHealthcare.com. And from Watercolors by Edith, Shutesbury, Massachusetts. Edith Hunsberger, a painter in acrylic and watercolors, specializing in portrait paintings of people and pets from photographs. Edith-Hunsberger.artistwebsites.com.
It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. Bob, this one came in via email from Larry, who says, dumb question. No dumb questions, Larry. Only I ask the dumb questions. All right. As the Big Bang was an expansion of time-space, what is the current scientific thinking about what exists outside of time-space? Mathematically speaking, a straight line can continue forever. How can you be sure there is nothing outside? If you traveled to the edge and stepped across, would you cease to exist? Isn't it possible that our time-space is merely a bubble in an infinite ocean? Just saying. That's from Larry.
Well, as soon as the word infinity is brought up, you have to shrug your shoulders because you can't prove infinity. The closest we came was a few years ago when a team at the University of Berkeley, studying 985,000 galaxies, found that out on the farthest reaches of space that we could study, space has a flat topology. In other words, stars aren't shifted from where they would be. And this indicates that the universe goes on and on beyond the visible universe, which ends at 13.8 billion light years away. So this was the first evidence that the universe is at least far larger than we thought and possibly infinite. So if it's infinite, wow, you can't prove infinity, but boy, that's something else again. That might mean that our parents were right, you know, when we were kids and said, hey, did the stars just go on and on? And they would say, oh, yeah, the stars just go on and on.
My parents never said that.
So, yeah, it's maybe true. So, but then if you ask, well, what's beyond that? Whether you call it space-time, and time and space individually may not even exist, by the way. But if you call it as an aggregate space-time, what would happen if you stepped outside of it? Is there an outside of it? You know, we don't know. So I'd have to make up stuff. And...
All right, fair enough. Yeah. Well, a couple more shots of NyQuil. I think you probably will. John in Lenox. John, you're on.
Yes, greetings, stargazers. I have a couple of questions. One is, what's the best way to predict where the Milky Way will be at various times of the night for night photography? You know, if you want it on the horizon, or if you want it in the middle of the sky or the other horizon, what's the best way to predict where the Milky Way will be at certain times of night?
Well, you know, I'm glad you're asking that. Are you talking about photography?
Yes.
Did you just say, I thought you said photography. Lately, the last few years, I've been noticing on the web, there's more and more gorgeous photographs showing the night sky, usually behind celestial objects like out west or with palm trees in the foreground. With the Milky Way in them. And you're absolutely right. The Milky Way is a necessary accoutrement to night photography because outside of the Milky Way, it's just a paltry scattering of stars. The Milky Way is this dramatic, detailed, beautifully interspaced with nebulae and strings and stuff like that. It makes the shot interesting. It changes it from routine to extraordinary. So you're right to want the Milky Way in that. So the Milky Way is best seen in August and September, the first few hours after nightfall, and then it crosses the whole sky from northeast to southwest. So that's the best time of year, August, September, even into October, the first few hours after nightfall. This time of year, right now in the spring, you'll catch it before dawn. You'd have to go out just before the sky starts brightening, talking about maybe 5:30 in the morning. And then, too, it'll be nicely across the sky. The brightest part of the Milky Way is in the south. Mm. That's the preferential direction.
You mean the southern hemisphere or to the south as we look?
To the south from here. In the southern hemisphere, it's better because the center of the galaxy, which is the brightest, most detailed part toward the constellation Sagittarius, is overhead only from the equator and places south of there. Actually, places south of there. Our annual tours to Chile exploit this. We go there to see the Milky Way overhead, and it's just breathtaking. From here, the center of the Milky Way at its best is always low,
but
it's south.
Now, we're in the Milky Way, so what exactly are we seeing? Cross-section?
Yes. We're seeing along the flat plane of it and toward the center of it. If you picture yourself trapped in a pancake, made up of almost a trillion glowing points of light, and you're a planet circling one of those little points, think about what you'd see. If you looked out the quick way out of the pancake, let's say the pancake was on in a pan, in a frying pan, you looked straight up, you're not going to see very much, and you're going to be out of the pancake. But if you look along the thickness of the pancake, that's the Milky Way. That's the glow, in other words, the thickest part of our galaxy seen from our worm's eye perspective, from within it. And the brightest section is when you look towards the center of it, because there's an extra concentration of material there. That's where that 4 million solar mass black hole is, too.
Our number here is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest, and Tony in Schenectady. Tony, you're on.
Hey, you know the way some people make it a goal to climb, like, the highest peaks in the Adirondacks in their lifetime? Well, I got a pair of 20x40 binoculars. Is it possible for me to see all the galaxies in our local group, like make that a goal, that with my 20x40 binoculars, I'll be able to see those galaxies?
How many are in the local group?
30.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, 20x40 is a little tough for the simple reason that 20 is half of 40. So you have 20 power, but only a 40 millimeter objective lens, which means your exit pupil on your binoculars is 2 millimeters, whereas the human eye gets dilated more than that, and you want maximum light to see these faint objects. So I wish you instead had 20 by 60 or 20 by 80 or 20 by 100 binoculars, because you'd still have 20 power, but you'd be letting in more light. Alternatively, I would prefer 10 power binoculars by 40, because then you'd be only demanding 10 power from those 40 millimeter lenses. Now, that said, you have another problem. That is, 20 power is twice as magnified as your hand can steadily hold. The human hand can't hold anything steady above about 10 power. The solution is usually those expensive image-stabilized binoculars made by Canon and by others.
Mm-hmm.
So 20 by 40, you're not going to hold it steady, and the image isn't going to be bright for celestial use. So now that I've finished making you feel bad about your binoculars, you know, I loved how you started with that hiking in the Adirondacks and bucket list things. And I said to myself when you started speaking, Tony, I said, I like this guy. This guy's great. So I apologize for now spending all this time putting down your binoculars. But if you were going to look for galaxies in our local group, of course, no problem with Andromeda. That's easy naked eye, especially in the fall. There's a galaxy called M33, not far from Andromeda. That's easily seen with your binoculars. Go down to the southern hemisphere, and you'll see our companion galaxies, the Magellanic Clouds, that are best seen from, let's say, Chile or South Africa or Australia or New Zealand. That's where you'd have to go to see those. Those are important members of our local group. And then beyond that, you get to some really smudgy, tiny, dim galaxies in Ursa Major and in other constellations that, because they're so small, really would require finder charts.
Well, I was thinking about the Pegasus dwarf galaxy.
Mm-hmm,
I seem to have a romantic ring to it.
Yep.
Would I be able to see that with my binoculars?
That's also faint. That, if I remember right, that's close to 10th magnitude. So see it, it would just be on the limit of what you could see as a very, very, very faint smudge. So
I got to buy a telescope?
Yes, or else binoculars that bring in more light, because these dwarf galaxies, it's not that you have to magnify them that much bigger, but you want them as bright as you can get them.
And to do that, you need more.
Yeah, you need what's called the exit pupil. So divide the first number into the second, and you'd like that to be at least 4.
So 20 by 80.
20 by 80 in that case, or 10 by 40.
Okay. Well, good luck, Tony. That's a noble cause, and we appreciate it. 800-348-2551, the number. Brian, who is going through Massachusetts. Brian, you're on.
Hi, thank you. I've seen the solar flares coming from the sun, and it shows the solar flares entering our power grid transformers and blowing them up. Now, what is doing that? Is that radiation, or is there other ingredients that the sun happens to be ejecting?
Boy, are you in luck, because Bob wrote a book about the sun's heartbeat, and you'll know all about this.
That's right. Spent a chapter or two just on this, especially the event on March 13th, 1989, where just the event you're talking about knocked a quarter of Canada into darkness because it blew out transformers of Hydro-Quebec. And most of the stuff that it's doing are subatomic particles interacting with Earth's magnetic field. You generate super amounts of electricity that way, and the electricity is reflected by auroras above and by corresponding electrical currents through any earthly rock that can carry a current. Now, much of Canada's eastern half has such rock. Otherwise, it'll course along power lines, knocking out transformers and that kind of thing. So it's mainly charged particles from the sun interacting with Earth's magnetosphere that does it. Very strong solar flares can produce direct consequences from shortwave photons of light.
Go ahead, Brian.
That's very well put. Now, let's look at the field of energy that we've created with cell phones, radar, all the unnatural energy that we've created in the field going around the Earth all the time. Would the sun be reacting or evolving in the last 100 years, noticing this electrical energy in the sun, building up a new chemical or atom or electrical field to say, hi, there's a new friend of mine called energy and says hi and blows up the transformers? Could the sun be evolving a new atom or molecular part of energy to maybe say hi to our energy or destroy our energy?
No, we're nothing to the sun. It would be like a flea hitting the windshield of a cement truck going down the highway. We're the sun doesn't care about us. We're and especially the energies you're talking about, cell phones, microwaves, that's RF, meaning radio frequency energy, happens to be unusually weak.
Okay.
When you look at the electromagnetic spectrum, light is fairly weak compared to, let's say, UV energy and X-rays and gamma rays. But weaker than light is infrared, which we perceive as heat. And weaker than infrared is the radio spectrum that we're responsible for at the moment throwing out into the air. And microwaves are part of the radio spectrum. So these are kind of things that are too wimpy. They can't even strip electrons off of atoms,
okay,
which is what you need to do to produce cancer and stuff. This is weak, wimpy stuff, which is why after 5,000 studies, they can't even decide whether it's harmful or not. I'm not going to get on the air here and say
we're almost
cell
done with
phone
the show,
stuff
Bob.
Is.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's harmless. I'm just saying if after 5,000 studies you can't pin it down, it's pretty, if it has an effect, it's pretty wimpy.
So you wrote the book, The Sun's Heartbeat. Your next book should be The Sun Doesn't Care About Us. Now that's a book. Let's go over to Howard in New Paltz. Howard, you're on.
Hey, how are you?
Good.
I just want your opinion on this. It's kind of it's one question, but it sounds like it's a written statement in a way, but... First, is the tide changed by the moon and planets? And to add to the question, does it have to do with time? And the other part of the questions are, does your time of birth and date have to do with where the planets are? And suppose we are all really a cluster of one instead of separate people, meaning that we are a planet ourselves.
Okay. All right. Well, hang in there, Howard.
All in one piece, but.
All right. So Bob's here. Bob, go to town, brother.
I can't go to town on whether we're a planet ourselves or whether.
Well, you wrote the books on biocentrism. Does this tie in at all?
No.
With a sentient universe?
No.
No.
No. The central theme, if there is that, of biocentrism, is that consciousness, which is obvious, awareness, perception, obviously that's part of human experience, and nature are correlative in some way. And we're doing this based on just strictly science, all these quantum mechanical events like the double slit experiment that shows that knowledge in our minds actually affects the result of the experiment. So the quest these days is to figure out in what way, to what degree, does consciousness and nature work together, and not giving any wacky answers to that, just using science.
Okay. Well, Howard, thanks a lot for the call. I got to tell you, I feel like I've been taking NyQuil now. This has been one hell of a show.
We can drink it together after the show.
I don't know, man. I got to drive. Let's go over to Marina in Cornwall. Marina, you're on.
Hey, I have a question about length contraction.
Sure.
I was reading it in a book about physics, and I talked to my physics teacher, and he said that he wasn't really sure about it, so I thought I would call.
Oh, yeah, absolutely true.
I've got a situation. So if an observer theoretically could watch someone run past them at 9/10 the speed of light, according to length contraction, the observer would see the runner with approximately twice the mass but half the length. Meanwhile, the runner would observe no change in themselves as far as mass and length because of the difference in
reference.
Reality depends on the observer, right?
Yes.
So how can mass grow but length contracts? Like, it seems to me that if mass is doubling, wouldn't length also appear to become larger?
No, actually the way you stated it is absolutely right, and it's always relative to you. So that's why Einstein introduced the idea of reference frames, which he used in both his 1905 special relativity and 1915 general relativity. The idea is that you and every observer, depending upon the gravitational field you're in and your speed, observes the rest of the universe in a certain way. And you will see, relative to yourself, length contracting, time slowing down, which you haven't mentioned yet.
Yeah, time dilation.
And time dilation and mass increase, all proportionate
to the speed, your speed, which is amazing, or the observer's speed, doesn't matter. So, yes, all of these things go together, and they go together in the same way. The famous Lorentz transformation, you probably, if you're knowledgeable enough to have asked the question, you probably know about that. T delta equals T times the square root of 1 minus V square over C square.
Yeah.
That same formula is applicable to all three, length, contraction, mass increase, and time dilation. They all work together. Depending upon your speed. And
well, Berman, what the hell just happened? I mean, we haven't done a show like this in a long time. My head hurts, and let's just call it a day. Support comes from Interactive Media Consulting, a team of online market strategists providing websites, branding, and digital marketing to the Capital Region and beyond. Since 1996, imediaconsult.com. George Heigel Antiques, Ballston Spa, New York, specializing in buying and selling antique collections for individuals, families, and businesses. 518-396-7974. Vermont Coffee Company, offering slow-roasted organic coffee in the brown paper bag at local grocery stores. Vermont Coffee Company, coffee roasted for friends. And Capital Car Share, a car-sharing network offering a fleet of eco-friendly vehicles for neighborhood transportation. 24-hour reservations available online. Capital Car Share. .org for donations and information. Well, once again, thanks to Bob Berman for trekking in here and not feeling so well. He did a great job. Thank you for calling and for the emails and for just plain old listening. Zach Malloy is our engineer. And thanks to Deb Malik, who answered the phones today. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. Tomorrow on Food Friday, we will learn how to use regional vegetables, herbs, and maple syrup. Okay, stand by for news.